Gentlemen, our first case for argument is State of Wisconsin versus the Stockbridge Muncie. Mr. Albright.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Corey Albright on behalf of the Stockbridge Muncie community and its president, Robert Schicks. There is one point that is critical to the proper disposition of this case, and that is the absence of any clear, plain, and specific congressional intent to diminish or disestablish the boundaries of the Stockbridge-Muncie Reservation as set forth in the plain language of the 1871 and 1906 Acts, their legislative history, and surrounding circumstances. Under this court's decision in Voight, the state bears a heavy burden to show with unequivocal evidence that Congress intended...
But why is that?
Yes, Your Honor?
Why is that? Why is that a heavy burden?
Because the Supreme Court has made it absolutely clear...
Yeah, why? Why? What is the basis of this presumption that you're basing your case on?
A treaty between the United States and Indian tribe may only be abrogated by
why?
Congress.
I'm asking you why. Is there a reason for that?
It's a solemn commitment. It's a supreme law of the land.
Why?
Your Honor, the treaty...
Is this a substantive presumption, based on judges' idea of policy, or is it interpretive, based on what it is believed Congress intends when it deals with Indian affairs?
Your Honor, this is a substantive presumption, and this Court's decision...
Where do substantive presumptions come from? From the Constitution, or what?
The Constitution sets forth that treaties are the supreme law of
the land. The Constitution doesn't set forth any presumptions, does it?
Your Honor, the Constitution does not set forth any presumptions.
So where do they come from?
They come from the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, which has found that only Congress has authority to abrogate a treaty between an Indian nation
yes, of course,
and the United States.
Of course, but when you're interpreting a statute, like this 1871 statute, 1906, 1934, whatever, why have a thumb on this scale? That's my question.
Your Honor, the plain language of the 1871 Act and the 1906 Act, setting all presumptions aside, that is dispositive in this case.
Well, if you have plain language, you don't need a presumption, right?
Your Honor, we do have plain language here. And in the plain language of both of those acts, in contrast to other legislation affecting the Stockbridge and Muncie tribe, Congress did not employ language evidencing an intent.
Yeah, well, that's not plain language, right? That's absence of language.
In 1839, 1848, and...
If I may interrupt there, Mr. Albright, for a moment. Your brief stresses the absence of plain language in the statute. It intimates that we are constrained to focus simply on the statutes. Are we, in fact, allowed to look at evidence other than the statutory text?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you do admit that we can go beyond the statutory text?
Absolutely. The legislative history and the surrounding circumstances. And here, the legislative history and surrounding circumstances do not reflect any intent to diminish or disestablish the boundaries of the Stockbridge-Muncie Reservation.
I was interested in the fact that the United States filed an amicus brief in the district court on your behalf,
yes, sir,
but has not filed one here.
Yes.
Is there any reason,
Your Honor,
for that?
The reason that the United States did not file an amicus brief before this court...
Is this in the record, by the way?
No, it is not.
Okay. But
the briefing schedule that was set when negotiations broke down in this case was extremely short, and when the tribe requested an amicus brief from the United States, it responded that the DOJ appellate attorneys would not have time to seek clearance, let alone to review the record and to prepare a brief.
But they could always ask us for extension, right?
They did not, yes, Your Honor. They did not.
They
didn't. Did they
ask us for an extension of time?
No, they did not. The United States expressed its support for the tribe and its intent to assist in any way possible.
I was wondering if the United States saw Judge Gorentz's 74-page opinion here and decided that stirred up a lot of problems and that they were not going to file, the government was not going to file an amicus brief on your behalf.
That is not what the United States informed the tribe, Your Honor. And it bears noting that the United States, the entire 20th century, the United States took the position that the Stockbridge-Munsee Reservation comprised the full two townships of Bartlemy and Red Springs. The very first event after the issuance of the fee patents in 1906 was an explanation from the Office of Indian Affairs, from the Assistant Commissioner, who explained in response to a question from the U.S. Attorney that no act of Congress had changed the two township boundaries of the Stockbridge-Munsee Reservation. The very next analysis conducted of those acts and of congressional intent occurred in 1974, and again, the Office of Indian Affairs concluded.
But suppose we go back to the 1871 statute. So what that said was that the Indian Party shall thenceforth be known as Stockbridge Tribe of Indians and may be located upon lands reserved by the second section of this act or such other reservation as may be procured for them. Well, isn't that pretty clear indication that the that they were not retaining the entire reservation?
No, it is not, Your Honor. That does not reflect that there was a new reservation. These 18 sections were lands that were now actually occupied and improved, and that was a prerequisite to reserving those lands from sale. This was not a new reservation.
That's the 18 sections, right?
Correct.
Yeah, that's the 18 sections.
This was not a new reservation, as had been contemplated.
Yeah, but it says, you know, the reservation is the 18 sections plus such other reservation as may be procured for them, which would be somewhere else, not the 54 sections. They're gone.
The 54 sections have been sold to the timber companies.
Right.
And it is purely a timber sale. The colloquy involving Congressman Armstrong.
But then why do they say the reservation is just the 18 sections plus such other reservation as may be procured for them?
The 1871 Act allows for the tribe to obtain a new reservation elsewhere. That never occurred. The tribe stayed on the same
land. No, I understand that, but it says that the Stockbridge tribe may be located upon the 18 sections or such other reservation, which, as you say, was never, well, there's something in the 30s or the 70s, but seems that there's no there's nothing that suggests the 54 sections are still part of their reservation.
The reservation that you refer to are the lands that were, quote, reserved from sale under Section 2. And this is very similar to the circumstances that the Supreme Court looked at in both Solemn and in Matz.
Well, why do they talk about such other reservation? Obviously, something's being taken away from them.
Title, Your Honor. Title to the 54 sections, not the reservation status. In Solomon and Seymour and in Matz, the United States was acting as a sales agent to raise money for a tribe. And here, the tribe was mired in dire circumstances. It couldn't farm its lands, and it was not being permitted to harvest the timber. This was a timber sale. And the reason that the contiguous 54 sections were sold to the timber industry was because it would maximize the financial return
but
of the tribe.
The Citizen Party didn't want to be on a reservation, right? They wanted to assimilate.
Your Honor, the Citizen Party vehemently opposed the 1871 Act. It was not an act that was a result of any bilateral agreement with the tribe whatsoever, and certainly not an agreement to expressly cede or relinquish all tribal interests in reservation lands. The tribe had repeatedly, in three prior treaties, 1839, 1848, and 1856, had expressly ceded and relinquished all interests in certain reservation lands. The Senate had considered a treaty that would have done that in 1867. Congress, however, did not choose that language, and the Supreme Court jurisprudence in Solemn.
What kind of federal enforcement goes on the 54 sections?
Your Honor, there is nothing in the record regarding federal jurisdiction.
It's not in the record. You better leave it out. So you're saying there's nothing in the record to indicate that there are any, you know, federal enforcement of federal law on the reservation. It's under Wisconsin control.
What is critical is that following this, the 1871 Act, no non-Indians moved, and in fact, the United States reacquired title to much of these lands. The United States didn't intend for non-Indians to settle here, and in fact, the Indians continued to hunt, to gather, and to fish on these lands until they were largely reacquired in the 1930s under the New Deal, when funds were appropriated that allowed the Department of Agriculture to reacquire these lands. So this did not...
I'm sorry. Please. I was going to follow up on Judge Posner's question. If, in a practical sense, let's hypothetically, a couple of golfers get in an argument, as they often do, and one assaults the other on the 18th green or something. What entity has jurisdiction to prosecute that criminal act?
Your Honor, the state of Wisconsin. And that's very important in this case. The boundaries of the two township reservation will have absolutely no impact on the state's criminal jurisdiction within these two townships. Wisconsin is a public law 280 state, and so the state exercises criminal jurisdiction throughout the two townships, regardless of reservation boundaries. Also, local governments do not stand to lose any property tax dollars. The tribe pays property tax on its fee lands within the two townships without objection. However, reservation status is extremely important to the tribe. These two townships are 63% Indian in population.
So what kind of Indian activities go on there?
Go on within the two townships?
Yeah.
Your Honor, the two townships since 1856 have been the Stockbridge-Munsee tribe's permanent
home. What goes on there? What in the way of Indian activities?
People live. They work. They hunt.
They
fish,
work well.
They raise families, Your Honor.
What kind of tribal structure and governance is there?
The tribe exercises jurisdiction over its members and over fee lands that are owned by the tribe or tribal members throughout the two townships. And this is evident in sources of law which are available on the tribe's website.
In my example, then, if there were two Indians that got into this fight, would some tribal court have jurisdiction over it? As opposed to the state of Wisconsin or the federal government?
No, the state of Wisconsin has jurisdiction over all crimes involving Indians within the reservation. For the minority non-Indian population, the minority 37%, reservation status has very little impact either. The tribe has no criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians, and the civil jurisdiction of the tribe over non-Indian and non-Indian fee lands is limited to very, very narrow circumstances. So reservation status doesn't impact the state's jurisdiction or the local governments in terms of the non-Indian population. Reservation status, however, is extremely important to the tribe and its members. As mentioned, the tribe's ordinances regulate throughout the two townships. Land use, water pollution control, truancy, garnishment, all of these sources of law, all of these tribal ordinances are in effect throughout the two townships. An important piece of evidence that shows that in this case, it is not the tribe seeking to change the status quo, it's the state. In the record, at docket number 41, exhibit 140, between 1989 and 1998, every year, Shawnee County and the Stockbridge-Munsee tribe entered a cooperative law enforcement agreement, cross-deputization, all kinds of things. These agreements explicitly recognize that the tribe's reservation is two townships, 46,000 acres, all of Bartlemy, all of Red Springs. So this is a very recent source of evidence that shows that the local governments, who are most intimately affected,
well, then why is there no federal presence? Because we get criminal cases from reservations in Wisconsin, but I gather you're saying here that law enforcement is by the state rather than by federal government.
It is, Your Honor, and that is under Public Law 280. The state supplants the federal jurisdiction over all Indian country in Wisconsin.
How can the state supplant
jurisdiction? Well, it's not the Menominee Reservation, is it?
Correct, Your Honor. There's been a retrocession of jurisdiction back to the...
How can the state supplant federal jurisdiction?
Because Congress has explicitly provided so in Public Law 280.
Just so I'm clear on that, the federal government has jurisdiction over any criminal acts committed on the Menominee Reservation, which borders this reservation.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But not on this one.
Public Law 280, 18 U.S.C. 1162, specifically granted the state criminal jurisdiction over all Indian country in Wisconsin. Subsequently, Congress passed a statute that allowed a state to voluntarily retrocede that jurisdiction back to the tribe in the United States. The Menominee Reservation is the only place in the state of Wisconsin where that has occurred. Another important piece of evidence that shows that the state here is seeking to change the status quo, not the tribe, is the very compact, gaming compact, that gave rise to this litigation in the first instance. That 1998 gaming compact, it's quoted on the very first page of the district court's opinion. It's in a stipulation of facts in the record at 26. It reflects an understanding by the state that the exterior boundaries of the Stockbridge-Munsee Reservation encompasses both fee lands and trust lands. It provides that the tribe may game on tribally owned fee lands or on trust lands. The state's litigation position is radically different from that 1998 gaming compact. Here, the state argues that the reservation only embraces trust lands, and that's evident in the supplemental appendix at page 6, where you see a map of the checkerboard of trust lands that the state argues in this case is the reservation. That's a radically different position than the state set forth in the gaming compact in 1998.
After the timbering, pursuant to the 1871 Act, I understand that the land was abandoned for a certain period?
Your Honor, the timber companies cut the timber and then left.
And left. Okay, so what happened next?
No non-Indians settled there, and as of 1910, there was no non-Indians. The tribe...
No. But presumably, there were no Indians there when the lumber companies were cutting the timber, were they?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so after the lumber companies were finished and abandoned the land, it was vacant. Now, at some point, what, people filtered back, started living there?
That is correct. People filtered back and actually squatted on these lands because nothing was occurring there. They were cut over lands, and these are the lands in 1906 that Congress hoped could be repurchased by the Secretary in order to provide allotments to tribal members. However, Congress only appropriated $2 per acre, and that was not enough to entice the timber companies to give title and the speculators who were holding title at that time. So it was not until the 1930s when the Department of Agriculture was able to formally reacquire title to these lands for the tribe's use.
Well, at what point was there substantial Indian habitation of these abandoned lands?
Substantial, Your Honor, I do not believe that occurred until the title to the lands was formally reacquired in the 1930s. I'd like to save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Albright. Mr. Green?
May it please the Court, my name is John Green. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin. I think it's important to get back to first principles here, and I think the most important one is the definition of an Indian reservation, because that's what's at stake here.
Let me ask you a very basic question. So this Pine Hills Casino Golf Club and so on, this is in operation?
Yes, sir.
And offering gambling? And then there's this North Star Club or... Casino?
Correct.
And is that operating too?
Yes, that's the main casino, which is on the
river. And presumably that's an Indian casino also?
Yes, sir.
And so what is this? Is the state trying to close these down or what?
The North Star Casino is on the tribe's new proclaimed reservation lands. What they did in 1998...
Don't use a word like proclaimed. It's on what you recognize to be their reservation?
Yes, it's
legit. So it's just the Pine Hills Club that's involved?
Correct.
That you want to close down?
And we did close down with the injunction granted in 1999 in this case. And that's why
you don't really want to close it down. You just want to stop the slot machines.
We have nothing against golf.
You don't have any problem with people playing golf.
Correct. But we could not allow slot machines to go in there under the compact. And contrary to counsel's statement a few minutes ago, the state in 1998 took the position, clearly that's why we brought this case, that location, the Pine Hills Golf Course, was outside the reservation and therefore under the compact was illegal for a gaming site. A reservation is an area that's set apart for the use of Indians under the protection and supervision of the federal government. And the authoritative source for that, apart from the Supreme Court, which we've cited, is Cohen's Handbook of Federal Indian Law. I would just note that at page 55 of our brief, we inadvertently dropped the page citation to Cohen, and it's important, so I'll give it to you. It's page 34. That's the 1982. There's now a 2005 update, and at page 189 of the 2005 Cohen, the definition of reservation is covered. You can't have a reservation if you don't have any land that's set apart or under the protection or supervision of the United States. And when all the land is fee patented, that means all restrictions are lifted and the United States has no role in the disposition of those lands. Can you have a reservation continue when some of the lands are allotted to tribal members? Certainly. That's what all the Allotment Acts did, and that's what the Supreme Court cases addressed. Can the reservation continue when you open up some of the surplus lands to non-Indian settlement? Certainly, and that's happened many times. Can you have a reservation where there's no longer any common tribal lands, that is, lands that are held by the tribe as opposed to individual tribal members? Yes, you can. In its reply brief, the tribe suggests that we're arguing that you have to have common tribal lands, but that's never been our argument. Our argument is that you have to have some lands that are still under restricted status and therefore under the superintendence of the United States. The cases that the tribe cites in their reply brief, the Michigan Chippewa cases, do suggest that there were no longer any common tribal lands, but if you look at those treaties cited, the individual allotted lands carried restrictions so that they weren't fee-patented unrestricted lands. The tribe's defense is based upon a legal impossibility. It would have seemed absurd to Congress or anyone else at the time of the 1906 Act that you could have a reservation when all the lands are fee patented and all the tribal members have become citizens. And that is the fatal flaw in the tribe's case. The tribe also uses the term allotment, I think, in a confusing way at times in its brief, and it's important to understand the meaning of the term allotment. Actually, there are multiple meanings, and that's the source of confusion. Typically, allotment meant the assignment of particular parcels to particular tribal members for their use. And that generally started out with restrictions so that the tribal member could not convey their title. This was for their protection, and the United States was the guardian. That's the normal use of allotment. Allotment sometimes was used loosely to mean the fee patenting of lands. And it's very important when the Supreme Court says mere allotment of lands is not enough to diminish. Those cases the Supreme Court has addressed have always involved surplus land acts and the allotment of lands with restrictions resulting in a checkerboard.
When you say fee patenting, is that any different from just fee? Are you saying that if the Indians are given, if all the land in a alleged reservation is owned in fee simple by individual Indian families, then you're saying it can't be a reservation?
Yes.
Just a factual matter here. How far is the North Star Casino from the Pine Hills golf course?
Well, it's in the adjoining town. There's two townships side by side. The North Star Casino is in Bartlemy, which is on the western one, and Pine Hills is in the northeast part of the Red Springs.
Is it a mile away? Five miles?
It's a few miles,
away?
Several miles, I would guess. Because the township is 6 miles by 6 miles.
It does raise the question, why this litigation?
Well, contrary to
because they could have as many casinos as they wanted in there. There's plenty of room in the 18 sections and the additional land that's been given them for casinos, isn't there? Is there something special about the location of Pine Hills that it's kind of gambling gold mine near some interstate or something?
No, actually it's not, Your Honor. But there's a lot more at stake here for the state and the non-tribal member residents than the tribe suggests. A lot of jurisdictional consequences flow from having land declared part of an Indian reservation. Taxes, tribal members who live on a reservation and work on the reservation are exempt from state income tax. That's a big issue. Environmental.
Have they been paying state income tax?
Some have. A lot have not. And that's,
have you tried to collect state income tax from
them?
Or awaiting the outcome of the case? Or?
We have agreed during the pendency of the case. Okay. In fact, we agreed to set up an escrow system so that tribal members could pay the equivalent tax in. And that money is sitting there waiting for the resolution of this case.
So, but before the litigation began, were you collecting state taxes or trying to, or was it all in limbo? Or?
I think it was in limbo. And I'm not sure that the Department of Revenue had a clear approach.
According to the North Star's website, they have 1,400 slot machines there. How many slot machines are they going to put on this, or would been proposed to be on this golf course?
You know, I can't remember the exact number, Your Honor. It might be in the complaint.
Certainly not 1,400.
Not 1,400
slot
but,
machines at a golf course.
And I hate to hazard a guess, but I think it might be in the complaint. By the way, today happens to be the 10th anniversary of the day we filed the complaint in this case. And in those 10 years, the tribe has been unable to point to any court decision or other example of a reservation with no restricted land. And I think that gets to the heart of the matter here. In terms of the...
There's no restricted land. So every piece of land is owned by an individual or family in fee simple?
In 1910.
Not in the 18... Pardon?
In 1910. When the 54 sections were auctioned off in the early 1870s under the 1871 Act, and they all went to non-Indian hands, mostly lumber companies. The remaining...
But did the lumber companies get fee simple or just timbering rights?
No,
cutting rights.
They got fee simple ownership.
But then they abandoned it, right? So someone else could have appropriated it?
Yes, and eventually it ended up, a lot of the land ended up in the hands of the federal government, and that's the land that the United States used to recreate the reservation in the 1930s and on. Neither of the...
So there are chunks, in the total 72 sections, there are chunks besides the 18 sections that are reservations, right? Later created reservations.
The reservation, and the maps that we put at the very beginning of our appendix are our depiction, not with precision, but roughly where the lands are. So the 1937, 1,050 acres, that was the first proclaimed reservation in the 1930s. That's in the northern part of the town of Bartlemy, which again is the western.
Right, right.
Most of the lands that are reservation today are in the town of Bartlemy. The tribe has also acquired trust lands in both townships outside the reservation boundaries. It's important.
But so you, apart from these federal government acquisitions, So are you arguing that the lumber companies got fee simple, then they abandoned it, and it was reappropriated, but it was reappropriated in fee simple. It was not so that there's been a chain of fee simple titles since the 1870s?
I believe that's correct,
John.
I don't believe that any of the land in the two townships went back into a restricted status until the 1937 proclamation. What was going on in the Surplus Land Acts that the Supreme Court addressed in its seven decisions on diminishment was not what was going on with the Stockbridge. This is a very, very different situation. This was not a case of a large western reservation, which the other cases involved, with lots of land, sometimes millions of acres of land, and a desire by Congress to open up the lands to settlement, but also to place tribal members on allotments and turn them into farmers. That was the essential assimilation policy. And to gradually, over time, with the assistance of homesteaders, this was the policy, they would prepare them for citizenship and termination of relations. In all of those cases, that process of assimilation was interrupted. It never went to completion, primarily because the land wasn't all sold. Time passed, and then Congress changed its policy with the Indian Reorganization Act. There was a sea change, and Congress essentially put the brakes on fee patenting of land and the lifting of restrictions. And then the policy was to try to maintain Indian land holdings and to add to the land base. The Stockbridge Acts are unique in that there was no surplus land to be opened for homesteading. There was no assimilated purpose here at all, because this tribe, by the middle of the 1800s, was highly assimilated. English-speaking, Protestant farmers. If there was any tribe in the United States that Congress would have deemed ready for the termination of tribal relations, this was it. And the tribe itself realized this, and a majority of the tribe, by the mid-1800s, was clamoring to be set free from federal supervision.
The Citizen Party was larger than the Indian Party?
Yes, and that's reflected. It's mentioned in the briefs. The draft 1867 treaty has the actual census of the two parties, and I believe it's about a 60-40 split, Citizen mm-hmm. to Indian. It's important to note that both of the acts of Congress were not unilateral acts by Congress, but they originated in requests by the tribe itself. And Congress essentially gave the tribe what it asked for. In 1871, the tribe wanted originally in the draft treaty, they wanted a new reservation somewhere else because this one was not conducive to farming. And Congress essentially incorporated that into the act with only two changes. One, they decided they would maximize the money that the tribe would receive. So instead of ceding the land and putting the land under the general land laws, which would be open at a very low price per acre, Congress actually decided to have an auction of the land to raise more money. And the record shows that auction sale brought in far more money than the tribe would have received under a cession. Secondly, the tribe wanted to split apart. The citizens wanted out. They wanted to cash out their tribal shares. The Indian Party wanted them out, and the act was designed to facilitate that by essentially allowing the citizens to cash out and by locating the small minority remnant Indian Party members on a new reservation, either 18 sections where they already were or somewhere else. The 1906 Act is even more stark in the circumstances. By the end of the century, everybody in the tribe wanted out of federal supervision. And this comes across very clear in their petition to the United States, which explicitly says, we are ready to be released from federal supervision. Please do whatever it takes to terminate our relations, give us fee patents, citizenship, and so forth. And that's exactly
what
Congress
did.
That is
also clear, though. Why would the federal government have filed an amicus brief on behalf of the tribe, look to the federal government, the Justice Department, for its view on the intent of Congress and many kinds of cases. And here, that was the government's position. It's contrary to the state of Wisconsin's position.
I have my own theory. I haven't talked to any of the federal attorneys, but I was surprised that they filed an amicus brief in the district court, primarily because the United States has for such a long period of time, taken the contrary position. That is the position that the reservation was disestablished as of 1910. And in fact, in 1981, the Interior Department allowed the Menominee Reservation to expand into the two townships that were part of the original 1856 Stockbridge Reservation. So the United States, if the tribe is correct, the United States made a huge error in recognizing Menominee Reservation over the top of a pre-existing Stockbridge Reservation. I think the United States may have realized that their position was untenable in light of their history. And if you look at the 1930s, the decisions were very explicit by the United States. There was no reservation.
I guess it's all speculation on why the United States did not file an amicus brief in this court. Nothing in the record, according to Mr. Albright. I assume you agree there's nothing in the record to tell us why the government decided.
That's correct, Your Honor. I would note that under the Indian Reorganization Act in the 1930s, the tribe suggests that all that the Secretary was saying with the proclamation was that there was no common land, but that is not what happen. And the Indian Reorganization Act, the statute is 25 U.S.C. 479. I'm quite sure that's the right statute. It required for recognition of a tribe that the tribe be residing on a reservation. There had to be a reservation, and the secretary, and at the time, was very, very favorably disposed to assist tribes to become reorganized. We're talking about John Collier and Felix Cohen, who was the solicitor. They determined there is no reservation. We have to get you a reservation first. In 1937, they proclaimed a new reservation, and then they recognized the Stockbridge as a tribe. The tribe may regret the course of history and the course of dealings in the past, but it is not the role of the court to rewrite that history. We submit that the district court clearly got it right in ascertaining the intent of Congress in that the 1871 Act diminished the reservation and the 1906 Act disestablished it. One thing that I omitted mention of is the case that was filed with the court yesterday, the Dewey case. In my brief time to look at that, I don't think that case adds anything of significance here. That case did not involve boundaries at all. As a matter of fact, that reservation in the Dewey case is the same reservation that the court addressed in Solemn. And we know that that's a classic checkerboard reservation where some lands passed out of Indian ownership and some did not. That was a case about the imposition of personal property taxes on trust property, horses, farming implements and equipment that the United States had made it a crime for any non-Indians to acquire. And the question there was whether or not the United States could sue on behalf of tribal members to recover taxes paid, despite the fact that they had received fee patents. It may be that some tribal members had received fee patents and some had become citizens, but we know that the reservation as a whole existed. That tribe was under active federal supervision, as the decisions themselves reflect.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Albright? A minute, 3 minutes?
Albright, could you respond to the statement by opposing counsel that the United States felt it was necessary to, in effect, reconstitute a reservation in the 37 Proclamation and because there was none? You've relied on the fact that there was longstanding administrative practice that supports your view, but apparently, and his view, of course, is to the contrary, that the United States recognized there was no reservation and one needed to be put together.
Yes, Your Honor. In 1911, the Office of Indian Affairs made clear that a two-township reservation existed. In 1924, that decision was reaffirmed in substance by the Swamplands lawsuit against the state of Wisconsin, based on the existence of the reservation. When the tribe applied for reorganization, it stated its territory as two townships, and when the tribe voted on its IRA constitution and on its articles of incorporation, which under the plain language of the IRA, voting was restricted to members on the reservation, members throughout the two townships voted. The reservation proclamation was a decision that Interior made based on information from the Land Division. And as we set out in our brief, the Land Division took the position that reservation acreage was equivalent with trust acreage. And at that time, there was no trust acreage. There was no in common lands. And so a decision was made to take lands into trust and to proclaim it a reservation. There was absolutely no analysis done by Collier or anyone else in the 1930s of the 1871 or of the 1906 Acts. The only analysis after 1911 comes in 1974. And in 1974, Deputy Commissioner of Indian Affairs, Kenneth Payton, rules exactly the same. The United States affirmed that two-township reservation in 1980 and 1985. Those are in the record at docket 156, 916, and 919, and again in 1996. I'd like to briefly respond to two questions that have been raised. Judge Evans, there is no gaming whatsoever occurring at Pine Hills. The tribe has no intent whatsoever to resume any gaming activities at Pine Hills. This is not a gaming case at all. There's no gaming there. The tribe has no plans to game there. Judge Posner, you've inquired of the Citizen Party. The Citizen Party, it's important to note, in 1893, Congress restored the Citizen Party to the membership. of the tribe. And at that time, in 1893, Congress explicitly referred to the two-township reservation created by the 1856 treaty, not to some hypothetical 18-section reservation. In 1893, it was the 1856 treaty reservation that Congress referred to.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Albright. And thank you, Mr. Green. Move to our second.